So again, I'd like to encourage everyone to generate the right intent of compassion. Once again, strengthening one's own mind into clearly the importance of recognizing this absolute, wonderful, and rare opportunity that we all have in not only obtaining this precious human existence, but that this precious human existence has met with the Dharma, not only having met with the Dharma, but that there is intrinsic of oneself the wish to truly bring it to fruition. So where that fruition needs to be generated, needs to be realized, may that realization and the path that leads to such a realization of the absolute truth not falter and not be destroyed and polluted by habitual tendencies of ego grasping, ego cherishing. May the path of Dharma not be distorted by the eight worldly concerns, where you use the Dharma to derive some kind of benefit that enriches nothing but the self-cherishing attitude. May the approach to Dharma, which of course, if combined together with the rising of wisdom, rising of virtuous qualities, does bring about, without our having an agenda to it, does have the power of producing causes of happiness and genuine goodness. Nevertheless, may it, however, not be distorted by an ego-cherishing attitude where we practice the Dharma simply for emotional gain, emotional happiness. In the same way, may it be free from the worldly concerns of trying to use the Dharma to free one's own ego from what it refers to as suffering, but is simply tremendous, unceasing flow of its own demands and expectations, and then mistakenly imagining or allowing ourselves to imagine that the unfulfillment, non-fulfillment of these demands and expectations to be seen as suffering. While we suffer some of that impact of pain, of not obtaining what we have, still that is not true meaning of what suffering is. And the involvement of the self in feeling its own emotional pain often discourages the insight, the wisdom mind, from addressing what true suffering is that other sentient beings may be going through. Therefore, freeing it from the worldly concerns of personal gain, personal loss, personal happiness, personal suffering, personal praise, personal blame, personal hope, personal fear, may I be able to generate a strengthened, pure attitude, which is nothing but a genuine, unbiased compassion for all sentient beings. That through having met with the Dharma and the sincerity brought into the engagement of the practices, may I have a strengthened attitude to correct the actions and the conduct and attitude of my body, speech and mind, such that the body becomes a vehicle of goodness and well-being for others. Speech becomes nothing but inspiring and kind towards the others, and the mind is able to have an unbiased altruism, genuine loving kindness for all sentient beings. It is for this reason alone that I engage in Dharma. It is only for this reason alone that I meditate. Every word that I hear of the Dharma, may it be to strengthen the spirit. Every meditation, even a small moment of quietness that I'm able to generate, may it build and strengthen this attitude, this determination to generate positive attitude and conduct. All the teachings, all the analysis, all the reflections and the insights, may it again be directed, given the right direction of bodhicitta, of building a strengthened attitude of kindness in my own, from the core of my own mind. And so such should be the intention generated prior to all sessions, whether it is reading Dharma, whether it is listening to Dharma, whether it is in your own meditation or different kinds of practices, what we call Buddhist practices, and in our general daily life. Such an attitude must always be kept as the life force of whatever that you are engaging in. Where such an intention is strong and straightforward, headed in the right direction, it encourages the mind to then spontaneously cultivate awakenedness, which, if familiarized and kept continued within one's own being, then develops into this mindfulness and genuine awareness that we strive to achieve through our various practices. And so, thinking in this way, we continue with the afternoon session, but at the same time also making sure that this is the attitude that is always strengthened in the practices. Jumping into any kind of practice, whether it is a formal practice that is well structured, or whether it is anything that one feels is a spiritual practice, without the right attitude, without generating the intention of bodhicitta, makes it completely directionless. And so this is then like a flying kite. And when the string of the kite is cut loose, then the kite just goes everywhere. It soars up and then it falls. And in the same way, one's own path of practice, what we call meditation or any kind of engaged practices, have completely become lost because the view of the mind becomes directionless. And so where that kind of a directionless approach to meditation is brought, of course it has enough spaces and gaps for familiar habitual patterns to come in. And so when we say, how can we overcome distraction? How can we overcome not being submerged within the same kleshas and the neuroses? The antidote to that is to have a firm, steady, good direction given from the very beginning of your practice session, which is crucial. I always say, you know, when you drive a car and you get into the driving seat and you turn the ignition on and you step on the accelerator, there is a part of your mind that knows whether to move forward or whether to back and then go forward, you know, not to hit on the left, right, front and back. And so that is then immediately knowing where you're going to lead the vehicle to, which direction, carefully, in what ways, so that you get to the destination. Where that is not done, then if you simply get in the car, turn the ignition on, step fully on the accelerator without care of where it is going, just because in your mind you want to reach a destination, pretty much like what I would do. I think it is a kind of driver that I am. You know, then the moment you step on the accelerator, it crashes. And then you wonder, what happened? Why didn't I get to the destination? There's a certain amount of sort of the view having to be brought in, the direction having to be brought in into the path of the practices. So in talking about training the mind also, the main thing, as we have been talking about, is a sense of cultivating, training mind in daily life, being able to truly engage all the teachings that one has understood, one has learned, immediately into particularly the attitude and the conduct of body, speech and mind. However, in order that what we are trying to engage upon, this morning we talked about accepting the challenges of the path of practice, such as accepting the challenge of the Eightfold Noble Path, or simply accepting the challenge of the slogans, transforming the three poisons into the three seeds of virtue. Well, however, until that process of completely embodying the path of practices, whether Eightfold Path, whether the 37 practices, whether simply compassion, in order to be able to fully engage in it, one must also have a very humble approach of knowing how unfamiliar we actually are. So therefore, we do try to practice patience instead of anger. We also try to practice kindness instead of selfishness. But at the same time, we are also very acutely aware that the aspiration doesn't always have the strength to be remaining constant within our mind stream. We have fallbacks. We have setbacks. We have tremendous amount of setbacks simply because the quotient, or the sort of, in terms of just the quantity of familiarity with the negative attitude versus the positive attitude, we find that the familiarity, the amount of familiarity that we have with distraction and simply giving in to the negative impulses are so strong, so much more familiar, so much more powerful than those sort of very fragile and very simple and very sort of short-lived moments of inspiration to transforming them into patience or selflessness attitudes. And therefore, since the familiarity itself is so weak, when it comes to generating kindness or doing the opposite of what our distracted mind is so accustomed to doing, we begin to recognize the importance of really working from not the basis of one's wishes and aspirations, but the basis of one's own potential and capability. And so, as Padmasambhava in his teachings say, the view must be as vast as possible, that it is like the eagle soaring unhesitatingly into the sky. But nevertheless, the feet of the practitioner have to be grounded in a thorough, realistic, and an honest knowledge of what one is capable of doing at this time. In recognizing one's own potential and capability, however, one must always keep in mind not to be complacent in having found your capability. Where you recognize your capability but you become complacent, you immediately impede development and progress. Knowing your own capability should immediately also be combined with the determination to progressively train, to progressively make it better, until the ground that you stand upon begins to blend, begins to merge and unify with the view where there is a state of inseparability between what you are, who you are, and the view that you understand to be true. In order, however, that the feet that you are standing upon, the capability and the potential that you carry, to be sustained and to be nurtured and then gradually progressed to such a fine and a pure state that it is indivisible from the absolute view itself, the sort of humble approach to giving yourself time and space to gain familiarity with your own qualities, with your own fundamental nature of mind becomes essential. Therefore, engage. The Lojong training, especially the training the mind through the 59 slogans, Atisha slogans, are a beautiful blend of contemplative approach and engaged approach. So they support one another. So in the beginning it says, for example, transform three poisons into the three seeds of virtue. But at the same time, it also goes into saying, yes, but nevertheless, where you find yourself challenged by not being able to fully transform negativities into the virtuous qualities, give yourself time and space to making your own mind able to hold such a powerful aspiration, such a difficult aspiration. And therefore, in one's own mind as a meditator, encouraging yourself to have a very realistic sort of approach to readying your mind such that it can become as aware and as strong to be able to transform all negativities into its virtuous opposite qualities. Starting with, in the ornament of Mahayana teachings of the Buddha, the Sutra teachings itself, it always says, begin always by generating in contemplation the thought of loving kindness towards all sentient beings. Beginning by first identifying within yourself the capacity to actually know and feel and recognize the power of loving kindness. And so later on in the writings of Lonchenpa, in which he speaks about the topic of cultivation of four immeasurable qualities, or again, another more detailed exposition of the same topic by Jigme Lingpa, for example. Later, if you find in other teachers' teachings also, you do find the similarity in the method given where it talks about think of your own parent or think of your own child, someone that you can identify as a person to whom you can feel unconditional love. First, identify with that. And so the purpose behind such a method applied in contemplation is to have this realistic approach of knowing the potential you do have. Where one's own potential is not recognized, it will always be sort of distorted and taken advantage of by the ego, which will make you almost imagine that you're incapable of unconditional love. That somehow you have to still study this. Somehow it is a very alien emotion that is extremely difficult to do. So when we talk about unconditional love, we almost have a feeling this is a pending project, something that will probably happen in the future, a capability that you do not have. And so when one does look into identifying someone in your life for whom you can have unconditional love, and in the general mode of our existence, it is a mother's love for her child, a child's love for her parent, or among partners, someone that you truly love. Healthcare givers have this great opportunity to work with people who are directly in situations of difficulty, so you have a sense of being able to completely embrace that person's suffering and through that give love, such an unconditional love which is without strategy, without planning. Unconditional love is whatever arises, however it is, to do your best, where there is no agenda involved, where there is no expectation involved, where there is primarily no strategy involved. You do not know how you are going to respond to it, but you are readying your mind to be available and conform to the needs of whatever might be best beneficial. Such an attitude is possible, and you do have that. As meditators trying to engage in working your mind to come up with such a basic wakefulness that it completely is free from all distortions of ego grasping, one needs to first tap into that very potential. Although very exclusive, although very partial, but nevertheless identify it so that one is able to have a reference of what you are actually trying to cultivate. And therefore, in meditation, really working with, thinking of people that you have tremendous love for. Start with the Buddha, if that's the only person that you can come up with whom you have no problems. Or the teacher, or whoever it is. But someone who awakens within oneself a sense of feeling, sort of, you can say, good luck, without a selfish reason. You can say, I wish you have a good day. I hope you enjoy today. I hope you have happiness today. Whatever circumstances arises, may it be good, may it give you a cause of happiness today. Working with that attitude, such that the mind begins to become fertile and accustomed to loving and thinking about loving in such a way that it is not sort of creating a trap, creating a strategy where it is trying to gain from that expression of love. So thinking each day, thinking of somebody in your own mind, bringing with force, with deliberateness. And the force and the deliberateness is good. So I think one of the mistakes we Buddhists try to make is we try to make everything non-grasping, empty in nature, brilliant from day one. It's because we think that's, you know, that's the language of the teaching so much. And so we think it has to be so. And jokingly, I always say, we're always terrified of grasping or fabricating because the teachings carry a language that affects psychologically, I think, in the minds where we think we have to do what the Buddha did without acknowledging the fact that he had at least a minimum of 1,000 lives to try that out before he attained enlightenment under a Bodhi tree. So what we ignore the fact is 1,000 lifetimes of rigorous hard work before he sat under the Bodhi tree. We head for the Bodhi tree immediately as soon as we know that there's such a thing as a potential of enlightenment. And so that's not being fair to yourself. That's not being kind to your own self. And so the most important thing is to know, yes, a greater potential of non-grasping is there. Greater potential of unconditional, unfabricated loving kindness is there. But realistically and honestly speaking, if that is still difficult, such a pristine generation of profound quality is difficult, start small. Start deliberately. Start with the grasping. But with the firm awareness that it does not need to retain the same stickiness or the same discursiveness such as grasping tomorrow. Tomorrow, reduce it. Like any sort of example, we could take the waxing moon, for example, where from no moon to a full moon day, there is a progressive growth and illumination of the moon. Likewise, your potential, your approach, as fabricated as it might start, gradually has to decrease, has the possibility to decrease. But where you have to start has to be from a very true approach, from an honest approach. Therefore, in that method of meditation, training your mind to truly think well of the others, to truly look at sentient beings in the eyes and to acknowledge them as living, breathing people who are in your lives, your family members, your parents, your husbands, your wives. In your own mind as a practitioner, knowing and acknowledging their aliveness, their feelings, their hopes, their fears, want of happiness, and the wish to be free from suffering. So that the intellectual mind doesn't come up with vague idea of sentient being, which is the most dangerous deception that we bring about. I always say, when we do our dedications or when we do our aspirations, may all benefit, may all sentient beings have happiness and the cause of happiness. When we think in that way, you have to look at the tendency of the mind that doesn't even actually know whom you are referring to at that moment. Whom do we mean by sentient beings? Somewhere, sometime in the future, you know, someone, no idea. By this merit, may all sentient beings benefit when we do our dedication. So our teachers used to say, look into your mind and know what do you mean by sentient beings. If they look like tiny black dots, no face, no identity, you don't know who you mean. But they are somewhere, someone. It's their responsibility to take what you have given. But you don't have the time nor the concentration and the effort to actually look and see who they mean. So we don't know who sentient beings are. We have all this love, which we randomly sort of throw. Doesn't matter whom it is. So long as we don't grasp, it's fine. So we just keep throwing, isn't it? Loving kindness and compassion, we keep expressing. There's no direction to it. There is no really feeling and an intimate relationship with what you are exuding at this, what you are projecting, what you are taking out from your mind being felt and experienced at this time. And so as that happens, it impedes the actually addressing the mind that needs to go through the transformation and the changes. It's a very lazy approach. It's an approach that has so many loopholes for the familiar patterns to immediately come back, distort, bring about the same kind of tendencies. And so we become good Buddhists, lazy good Buddhists. We become good Buddhists, arrogant, lazy Buddhists. We become good Buddhists, selfishly arrogant, lazy Buddhists. You know, so we can keep on adding to that. And, you know, we don't mean to do that. But what happens is we do a lot. But as Paturumuche in his examples talk about, is like a vessel with a hole in it. Is that you do pour into it, but the hole continuously drains whatever you pour into it. And so there is this unceasing effort that we put into it without it really filling up the mind with the wisdom that is needed in order to bring about the cessation of the causes that lead to suffering for self and the others. And so, therefore, sincerely recognizing the need of developing a strengthened attitude, not yours, not theirs, but my own attitude, and working within one's own self to sit and really think about at least one person for whom you can feel unconditional love. Later on, we can progress to liberating all sentient beings. Here, one person, and arouse through the reference of that one person the spirit of genuinely wishing nothing but happiness and causes of happiness, unconditionally wishing happiness for the others. Meditate, thinking that way for some time, every day of your life. Where you rigorously and with discipline generate a sense of really arousing loving kindness, since the intrinsic mind is itself inherently pure, it does click in at some point. But for it to click in with what you are addressing at that time, it does need familiarity. Familiarity requires the discipline of doing it every day of your life. Where the discipline of every day cultivating awareness in your life is impeded, then distraction, being so many, so easy to come, the disruption itself doesn't become or let the inherent wisdom to be able to connect with the spirit that you are generating as your motivation. Therefore, with the rigorous discipline of constantly training your mind to think about genuine wish of happiness and the cause of happiness to this one person, and more if you are able to be someone who can include more, really wishing them happiness and the cause of happiness, when it is that the clicking in with your own pristine nature will one day definitely arise as a question, why can't you do it for all? What's the difference that allows you to allow, sort of keeping your loving kindness so exclusive that it is not able to go beyond whom you are looking at or feel this unconditional love for? So that question definitely comes, even in our meditations, a little bit of this kind of meditation when we do, gradually the blessings of the meditation and then what is called the sort of the adhishthana in Sanskrit, or the siddhis, the accomplishment, the fruit, result of the meditation is, you do begin to come to a point in your life where it is like every day you look into the mirror, into your own face. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you are able to one day say, well, I should do something about that wart, you know, which we try to ignore most often times, isn't it? So in the same way, you do come to a point where you cannot look carefully at the unconditional love that you are generating and still not come to the direct contrast of what you're capable of doing and what you're not doing. So when that question comes, that awakens in you a greater inspiration. If you can specially sustain that question to you, when you observe within you how much you give to one and you don't give to the others, how easy it is to be selective and very exclusive in your approach to loving kindness. How you do have the potential, but how you restrict that potential to be trapped in the boundary of your own bias and partiality. Those things that become noticed and through awareness and through the discipline of regular practice, when you become aware of that, it is a very uncomfortable thought that lingers on. If such a meditator is able to recognize that, then it allows the first sort of what I call shake that dethrones or tends or plans to dethrone the supremacy of the self-cherishing attitude. So the anxiousness or the restlessness of the ego can be felt immediately by the meditator. And so that kind of a more direct attack to your own mistaken concepts and clearly recognizing how your mind can be so deceptive that even the loving kindness is so very exclusive, that it can be so very biased, speaks much more directly and poignantly than anything else, such as read in books, taught by others, or heard from others. Therefore, in order to really attack the control or decrease the control of the self-cherishing attitude, consistently meditating in generating loving kindness, beginning from one, gradually expanding to more, until you can incorporate every sentient being within the same flavor. Where difficulties arise, asking, why is that difficulty coming? Why is that bias coming? Where easiness comes, again looking at where that partiality is coming, where that attachment is coming. Being able to look into one's own self becomes necessary. But then, as Longchenpa says in the exposition of the Four Immeasurables, he talks about such a loving kindness meditation often will come to a point where the exclusiveness of it will be a very, what he calls, caressing sort of a thought in one's own mind. That you're so comfortable with your loving kindness that the loving kindness becomes very exclusive. Therefore, in order to temper that, in order to contradict this exclusivity, it should always also embody in the same session meditation on compassion, the second immeasurable, which is by not only wishing goodness on the others, but reflecting upon the suffering of the sentient beings. Why compassion is so difficult to generate mainly is because we do not have sympathy. And we do not have sympathy primarily because none of us actually know what suffering is. One of the good things about the positive karmas that we have created is most of us, well, you know, when we say we are very fortunate in having met with the Dharma, obtained the precious human existence, the downside of it is that we've begun to actually be someone who has been very fortunate in having lots of good situations, lot of good circumstances. Many of us have certain difficulties. We may have gotten cancer, we may have had separations, we may have lost a family, friend, whatever it is. We may have be materially very, very poor. We may have lost a job. There are those difficulties, definitely. But they are not strong enough to build up revulsion to the root causes that bring about tremendous suffering. There is still enough hope you'll find somebody else. Still hope you'll find a job. Still hope you'll build another house, that you'll go somewhere else. And therefore, because the chances of your hope and your hope leading you to believe that there are better opportunities still possible, mind still has more draw towards the creations of those different kinds of manifestations of the hope, rather than having a sense of really poignantly seeing the futility of samsara, of seeing what actual, you know, some suffering of samsara is. So what we do become is this: we become very much meditators thinking about suffering of samsara from a very rose-tinted kind of a glass. So I always have felt that one of the biggest obstacles we have is we don't know what suffering is. We read books on suffering. Your approach to reading Gampopa, or even better, Padma Rinpoche's Words of My Perfect Teacher, this is absolutely clear about suffering. I don't know whether it's still the situation, but when the book first came out, it was sort of encouraged by all the teachers that that be the book that every student of Buddha Dharma read. But I myself know of many people who had a lot of resistance to reading, especially the chapter on the suffering of sentient beings, because it's scary, I guess. It's scary in that it talks about the hell realms and the tongues being taken out and the body being cut into 8 pieces, and if you're lucky, 8 pieces. If not, then into 19 or 18 pieces or how much ever it is, and bursting into 4-petal lotus and the blistering hell and the crying hell and the wallowing hell. You know, those descriptions. Number one, you have difficulty in believing that will happen. Number two, it sounds terrible. You know, that's the intention of Patarubuche. That's the intention of the teachings. And the most important thing is, Dengukken Zarumuchi used to always say, is it's a drop in what is actually there. But here the point is that even in reading about it, it terrifies us. And so we have the option to shut the book and say, oh, this is all Tibetan. Prove to me, where's karma? Prove to me, where's the suffering of, you know, 6 realms? I came from a Catholic background, troubled by the fact that there is one hell. And now today, having become a Buddhist, you're telling me there are 18 different kinds of hell. You know, those kind of resistances that a lot of people experienced. So if you look at it, what it does point out to is how easy we have in that we try to, number one, understand suffering in this way. By books, by TV, by an intellectual understanding of what it is. But the TV can be shut off, a book can be closed, and the mind can practically shut down the information that it can get, because the circumstances in which we are in have plenty of good circumstances where we can switch our concentration to something that is more enticing, that is more pleasant to our emotions, to our feelings. So at that point, what does happen is that the heart and the mind of such a meditator never really addresses issues that are truly there in the world that are facts. So where we do not engage in situations where there are suffering, we become very, very exclusive in our compassion too. So we have a joke in the Tibetan tradition of the famous king of Derge, now in the Kham Eastern Province, which was an independent kingdom at one time. There was this well-known, I don't know particular which king it is, but the Derge king is said to have looked out one day in a blizzard, terribly, several days of great blizzard, very, very cold weather, snow and ice everywhere. And the poor people of his kingdom going out begging in the blizzard, the king is said to have looked out of the window and asked his attendant, why are these foolish people going out in a blizzard? Why don't they just go inside and have a hot soup and drink their chang and go to bed on this kind of a cold day? And so the attendant, it is said, didn't know what to say to the king, who himself had never experienced a day without food. And so this kind of a story is often used to present the exclusivity of our own mind that relates to all that what we are talking about based on one's own experiences, such as this king who thought, who walks out on a cold day begging for food? Why don't you just have your hot soup and beer and go to bed like I do? And so we think that's a silly thing to do, to go out in a blizzard. But that person who actually is at home with children without food, without any kind of means, has no other option but to go out in the blizzard hoping to find something. That's a very different experience. But when we relate to only our experience and never the expansion of the mind to know what is happening in the real world outside, such a same mind. Now, for example, this king of Derge doing practice of compassion. So what would his idea of compassion be? What would his idea of suffering be? So this, we are not very far or very, very different from this king itself, is that we do have an idea of what suffering is, but it's pretty much based upon one's own feelings and emotions. And so therefore, that kind of a love or compassion is, of course, love and compassion, but it is still not strong enough to awaken stupor and dullness of many, many lifetimes of ignorance and self-attachment. So therefore, to be able to generate genuine compassion, expanding the horizons of one's own understanding of what suffering is very essential. May all sentient beings be free from suffering, and the causes of suffering, and looking at all the suffering and the causes of suffering to really awaken in one's own mind an understanding of what this is when we call samsara, caused by ignorance. And so even in the monks and the nuns, when we relate to monks and the nuns, these days, one of the very interesting things I have found is engaging the monks and nuns, particularly the nuns with whom I work, in projects which take them out of their own nunneries or retreat centers or monasteries to work with, whether it is the children who are without homes, or whether it is aged people or the seniors who are without homes, or the animal projects, or all of the difficult situations with the people with different health diseases, the blind people, and so forth. And then they go in there, and then the change that happens in their mind when they engage with a person who has no limbs, when they look at, let's say, a dog in an animal shelter that has been, half the body has been squished by a moving car, can neither be alive, is not dead. There's absolutely no vet or doctor who will come to do anything because there's no hope, but the animal just will not die. So when you come to that kind of a situation and you see what suffering actually is, you go back and then you stop complaining about having to share your room with another person who snores. Isn't it? Those are the suffering that we experience normally. The soup, noodle soup that we get, thukpa we get in the evening. One of the complaints in the nunnery often is people in the front don't put quickly, and by the time you get there, it's cold in the winter. So, you know, I wanted to eat a hot soup of noodle, and now today it's sort of colder, not even totally cool, but colder. Or I wanted to sit there and I didn't get place to sit here. I wanted a text today that didn't come today. We wanted to sit, but my neck pain and my back pain and my knee pain. So those are they not suffering? Of course they are suffering. They are pain, they are suffering. When we encounter them, they are challenging. But on the other hand, life and death doesn't, it's not life and death situation. It is not that absolute, abject pain where there isn't anything anyone can do about it. Your knee pains, who will stop you from stretching your legs? If you want to lie down and do your mantras, that's absolutely fine. No Buddha is going to come after you with a stick. But then there are those situations of suffering that has to be understood by a mind. Otherwise, when even a simple, single thing such as a dying animal's thought rarely occurs to our mind, it is the same mind that is going to try and liberate all sentient beings someday without some kind of an agenda involved in it. That's really a joke, isn't it? So therefore, the being able to really look through this kind of an analysis requires it to start from building a sympathetic attitude that understands sufferings of the others. Wherever and whenever you do get a situation or a chance, an opportunity to actually engage in such a work, do so. I encourage Buddhists that as important as it is to be disciplined in your formal practice, to constantly go out of your comfortable places, to engage in those situations where real physical need to help and to be able to be of service and understand the difficult situations is absolutely important. It is as much good for the others, tremendously good for your own self. So a lot of times people say, how can I be kind to myself? The best way to be kind to yourself is to wake up with a greater understanding of the realities of life and what we human beings can create for one another, to come out of that comfortable zone. That way, the awakenedness that arises is far more powerful for your own practice. And so, thinking of all the diverse experiences, but on the other hand, also not only looking for the tremendously painful or sort of difficult situation. Of course, as I said, be involved in such. But there are just immediately around you plenty of suffering, plenty of confusion, plenty of insecurities. They may not be bleeding. They may not have been run over by a car. They may not look ugly. They may not be so in a bad situation that they're going without food for the day. But the intensity of the hurt still is there. Pain is still there. Confusion is still there. Take a person you know who's very angry. Take a person whom you know to be very lonely. Take a person you know who has absolutely no one to rely upon, a confused person. To that person, bringing to your mind a sense of deepened understanding and sympathy, if you cannot even solve anything, but at least having a heart that nurtures sympathetically the absolute lack of control that one feels and experiences within your own mind, that will make you, what will it do? What good will come out of it for you is that you will come out of this very imaginary world, of this very beautiful sort of a citadel that you have created for your own self, that simply becomes sustaining of the arrogance, the ego, and the self-cherishing attitude. And so that then, again, dismantles, as I said, it dethrones the supremacy of the egoistic tendencies, the sort of selfish attitude that is there within one's own self. Furthermore, cultivate joyfulness. Know of all the different experiences or explanations of joyfulness is this enthusiasm to continually be kind, to have love, to have sympathy for the sufferings of the others and develop compassion. A quality of your being able to recognize this and cultivate it must be treasured. If you do not see the profound brilliance of that capability that you have a sympathetic heart and to be happy in it, that you're able to feel love and express it to the others, and that is a good thing. That is a wonderful quality that you find in your own self. And to see that and make that the basis of joyfulness in your engagement in something that is good and worthwhile, beneficial for self and the others, for a beginner on the path of practice is very, very important. Here again is the same, I think, obstacle where we think, oh, but this is then pride. Oh, this is then grasping. I should not have pride. I should not have grasping. If you truly think you have the capacity to encourage yourself without any grasping, then that's very good. I personally, myself, find it very difficult. I hope one day I can do it without grasping. I can do it without liking what I do. But at the moment, if that grasping, if that pride in the quality that you discover in yourself can be the basis of greater encouragement for you to do the same tomorrow and repeatedly again and again, then I think it's wise to choose to be happy about it. To be encouraged, to be enthusiastic, to know this is good, to be able to really have the sense of joyfulness in the opportunities that you are able to find in your own self is an excellent basis for renewed enthusiasm, to encourage yourself to go beyond doubts and hesitation. Otherwise, what's the other choice? Dismal Buddhist. So sort of, I don't know whether you articulate it in that many kind of words, but I often think down the line after many years, people often, in the beginning, of course, you're all sort of very happy that you've met with the Dharma and, you know, we're doing something very right and correct and so forth. But after many years, there are some meditators I come across whom I think have begun to almost think, why me? Should have never walked into that door kind of a person. Maybe it's not as bad as that, but still a sense of having the burden. So you're burdened with having to be good. Yeah. You can't enjoy life. You're supposed to have non-grasping. You have to always be kind to the others. What about me? So that kind of a sense of discouragement, sense of despair, sense of not feeling the happiness, the sort of joyfulness of really actually doing something remarkable in your life is, I think, very, very discouraging to whatever little amounts of good work that we are able to do. So joyfulness and being able to really understand and recognize the potential, the enthusiasm, the exertions that you do put into generating loving kindness and compassion becomes essential. Each session of meditation that works with generating loving kindness, compassion, and then finding joy in it, however, must always be tempered, balanced with a session of quietness. The fourth immeasurable quality of equanimity, generating a sense of this feeling of love, this feeling of compassion, this feeling of joy, to then not become a turmoiled emotion. Because if it is, then again, not brought down on the sort of balance of equanimity, then it can become an emotional entertainment. You go on and on with the story. It's the same kind of habit that you would have when you have done something good and then you call everybody up and sort of find out what the other person thinks about how good a job you have done. So, you know, the repetitions and then the sort of going back to it again, that's the emotional sort of turmoil that you are trying to keep consistent by the effort that you have put into it. That then changes it to becoming emotional clinging rather than what has started off in a very good way. Becoming better becomes, again, sort of have a setback with one's own sort of clinging or attitude of pride in it. In order that this does not happen, that there is joyfulness, but the joyfulness is a non-sticky kind of a joyfulness, that the joyfulness remains an enthusiasm and renewed vigor, but that it doesn't become self-absorbed. Being the conclusion of a session should always be with a sense of holding what you are generating to be the basis of your own mind. It is your mind that is answering what it is, its own potential, what is its own sort of basis. Therefore, the equanimity of stillness, of silence, of being able to sever the running commentaries of whatever thoughts that you have generated, kindness, compassion, or joyfulness, and being able to allow it to be free from bias and partiality, from giving, from making too much more than what it actually needs to be. Sense of settledness. This is an excellent joyfulness, but recognizing it to be another beautiful display of your own mind, that it is compassion, but it is not something uniquely different that you have obtained. It is the natural expression of your own mind. It is loving kindness, and you have enjoyed it, and it has been truly good, but at the same time, it is not distinct from the basis of your own mind. And so the sort of analogy I like to give at this point is sort of when you find your way back home, how exciting is it? You know, you go to job every day or you go out and then you return back home and you step into your own doors. How excited are you to have found your home? That's nothing exciting, isn't it? You don't clap and say, congratulations, I found my home. You don't do that. It's a very normal, natural thing that really comes back to your own home. Sort of equanimity is sort of that. There are all the good things. It's very good there is loving kindness. There is compassion. There is joyfulness. But it is your own natural nature. And the heightened neurosis of seeing it as being so separate would only be your ego allowing you to believe that it is an alien thing to you, that it is not your natural nature. And the sense of being able to say, this is my natural nature. It is the very pristine quality of my mind. Good when you experienced it, but here, since it is your own natural nature of your mind, simply rest within that, sever any kind of continued indulgence with that kind of a thought. These taken on, the four immeasurable practices taken on into the practices, allows a gradual sort seeding, sort of a settling into a greater awareness of a heart, of a mind that is supple, that is more gentle. This mind, when teamed together with engaged activities, allows oneself to then better deal with what the third point of training the mind, regard all adversities, transform all adversities into the path of Bodhi. Those of you who studied Lojong slogans know that when the first point of mind training is to recognize fundamental nature of mind. Second is much more to do with relative bodhicitta, being able to engage in all the transformations of the negativities into positive qualities, such as the four immeasurables that we talked about. These are all in the context of working with relative bodhicitta, primarily working with aspiration and then taking it into engagement. But of the seven points, one of the most remarkably sort of strong points, I think, is the third point of training the mind. Transform all adversities into the path of Bodhi, into the path of awakeness. In order to be able to encounter adversities and relate to them as the best things that have happened to your life, as your best friends, is an extremely difficult thing to do. So therefore, prior to trying to sort of generate that kind of a potential, it is important to work with the four immeasurables to cultivate a sense of much more intimacy and a deepened relationship with the sentient beings, with everyone around yourself. When you know love, when you are able to identify compassion, when you are able to really see the true potential of loving kindness and compassion and derive your own enthusiastic joy in being able to work with these potentials, this is better sort of, if we may use the word ammunition, that you are well equipped with in order to be able to face the outer world. Where the inner mind hasn't had the time to become more strengthened in its own awareness, the power of mind in that it relates to all projections, every projection is its own expression, mind's own expression, and in building the quality of sympathetic compassion and genuine kindness, unconditional kindness to the others, immediately setting out to dealing with the imperfections of the world, then is a very premature step. And so most oftentimes we make that mistake as we hear teachings on Mahayana, bodhicitta, cultivating heart of compassion. And of course, since it is, as I said, it is your home base, compassion and kindness is your own intrinsic nature. Therefore, it's very easy for the mind to click in with the teachings and to be able to see how true it is, how nice it is. But since the homework with your own mind hasn't really been done and taken care of, you haven't really processed your own attitude very much, therefore, a premature indulgence with immediately trying to transform adversities into compassion or into kindness can be very, very difficult and discouraging most often times. And so enthusiastically, how many times we receive teachings, we've taken bodhisattva vows, and then for the first few days, then we are nothing but generously kind, and we're trying to be patient and trying to be understand. But if you have had a sincere approach to training in the bodhisattva attitude, we all know how we fail and how bad we feel about how we have failed. And so we find, yes, generosity, we do try to practice, but we forget it more often than we actually practice. Patience is also something that we've all committed to. Those of you who've taken bodhisattva vow, we've taken the commitment not to be anything but patient. But then still, it is very difficult. And where the difficulty comes, the discouragement is not so far behind. And so in order that that kind of a discouragement doesn't happen, it becomes very important to really first train one's own attitude, one's own mind, through meditation, through contemplation, and then to work with the adversities. But meeting with the adversities and transforming them into becoming causes that are the best for you is absolutely necessary. In terms of the slogans itself, it says, drive all blames into one. With regard to the third point of training the mind, transform adversities. The first slogan, the first two slogans that are related to relative bodhicitta is drive all blames into one, be grateful to everyone. And so it's a very simple approach. Sure, all blames can be put to nothing but the ego-cherishing mind. Ultimately, it is that. But do we have a clearer understanding of how it is the blame is no one else's but the ego-cherishing mind? And so when we look at, for example, one of the clear metaphors that can be used over here is when we talk about Buddha's own enlightenment. As a child, the first book I remember reading was given to me by the older nuns, was on the life of the Buddha, a comic book on the life of the Buddha. And what I remember are the images just prior to the Buddha's attainment of enlightenment. Beautiful sort of, I think, women seductively dancing, monstrous beings poking spears and swords at the Buddha, you know, fierce lightning and thunder and sounds of various kinds of things happening, and the Buddha meditating under the Bodhi tree, not disturbed and distracted by any of these impediments. And then the next picture shows sun arising and the Buddha illuminating light and enlightenment. Now those kind of pictures, images, if we keep in mind, in our life, seductively goddesses dancing in traditional gear with beautiful music, does that happen? Monstrous demons with horns and fangs poking spear into your heart, does that happen? When you're meditating, thunder and lightning and your roof flies off, you know, and big serpents and monsters and dragons with spewing fires, do they come and sort of disturb your meditation? Most probably not. They come in other forms. They come in the forms of what the Buddha himself taught, as the four Maras, the four demons. They come in the form of forms, the aggregate form, in the form of different kinds of feelings and sensations. Maybe they are not as beautiful and seductive as these goddesses are, but these forms can be just as enticing. It could be a donut. It could be a latte, isn't it? It could be your friend. It could be your wish to find a partner. It could be your plans, whatever it is. Although the form and the image may not be of a monster, but the work is done. The mission is accomplished. And therefore, in our own lives, what are adversities? Adversities are, yes, as Buddha himself said, one of the Maras is the adversity of death, of sickness, of old age, of all the different kinds of losses in relationship and in material wealth. Those are different kinds of various obstructions that we can encounter. But beyond that, more oftentimes we meet with klesha maras, destructive afflictions and emotional maras, of just insecurity, of loneliness, of greed, of arrogance, of the sense of an agenda that needs to be fulfilled, such as you're becoming a learned practitioner who can teach somebody else. When people say things like, I love to teach the Dharma. So how is that not a Mara? Isn't it? Teaching the Dharma is said to be the best gift that you can give to the others. When we talk in the context of generosity, we say generosity of material wealth, which is the least important, generosity of your body in service, that's better than material wealth. Generosity of protection, that's the supreme gift. But then the absolute generosity is the gift of Dharma to the others. However, if that, then teaching is being manipulated. You don't want to give your body, you don't want to give your material, you don't want to correct yourself, so you think, oh, I'll give the best one, gift of Dharma. And extol teachings, which today are so sad when people say, you know, this is the purity of the Buddha's teachings. I don't practice it, but you do. You know, lots of times people do say that. Don't look at what I do, hear what I'm saying, or something like that. Which are the many different deceptions that the mind can come. We may not necessarily choose to sit on a pedestal or a throne and teach, but we do give a lot of advices to people. We tell other people how to handle their emotions, to let go, to be kind, to be patient and understanding, to be more objective about seeing the reality of a situation before making a judgment and a decision. But the same thing, if not practiced by one's own self, that's a wonderful Mara that you have created, a demon that you have created for your own self, perception Maras, your mind Maras, the neurosis, the klesha Maras, death Mara. And then the fourth Mara is often called the Laibuidu, what we call Maras of Devaputra, God, sons of God. Devaputra is sons of God. So that's Mara is of just laziness, dwelling in a sense of complacency and always trying to find the most convenient way. Is that tendency that the mind tricks itself into dwelling upon, which can never allow the person, meditator, to break free from the deceptions of ego grasping and ego clinging. And therefore, what happens? Suffering is continued. We don't do anything about it. Our attention is constantly drawn towards more other impulses of anger, of greed, of indifferent attitudes of ignorance, of jealousy, of selfishness, sustaining it day by day, where it eats up and decreases every virtue, every possibility of a precious human existence, manifesting its absolute true potential and capability. Transforming adversities, yes, of course, there are all different kinds of explanations, changing anger to patience, encountering difficulties, as the slogans itself says, be grateful to everyone. What does it mean is, when someone is unkind to you, the Lojong training of the mind teaches us to take that as a gift of the teachers, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas blessing you with an opportunity to now practice patience. If somebody, something that you love very much is being taken away from you, rather than giving in to fear and apprehension, aggression and selfishness, seeing that as another wonderful opportunity to give away, truly engaging in the defeating of a self-grasping attitude, simply because, as we talked about last night, ultimately, it is your mind. That mind which is empty in nature holds everything. And within that everything is what you have as well as what you do not have. And so if everything is based upon your own projections, a projection this way or that way should not be that powerful enough to deter your own mind. So however, seeing that that is the core from where we are coming to training the mind, it becomes essential to, yes, actually engage in incorporating these slogans, such as being grateful to all those adversities that come your way, as a finer, much more direct way of examining how you are able to cultivate awareness and selflessness in your path of practice. That's one approach. But on the other approach, as I said, well, that for those, especially in today's world where there is so much nice social niceties, the sort of people asking you directly to give away something may be still rarer. So more than those adversities, you have to work with the adversities that you are churning out in your own self. And therefore, the klesha maras, the different defilements, the different kinds of false concepts that your mind imagines, because of which you have the foundation on which you base your doubts, suspicion, unfriendly attitude, arrogance, pride, ambitions, and so forth. So being able to really look at those and then transform those adversities to bodhi, which means awakened awareness or awakened mind, which simply is knowing how deceptive everything is, how you create your own storyline, how everything what you think is suffering may not actually be what you think it is, but that the core cause from where it is originating is simply a very strong self-cherishing attitude. And so therefore, the transforming the adversities into the path of Bodhi goes into primarily two slogans that have to be cultivated as approaches, relative bodhicitta approaches. Absolutely the same has to be then transformed, where it says, don the armor of shunyata, by being able to look at the trikaya nature of the adversities. That is then the training the mind, taking on the approach of absolute bodhicitta in order to transform adversities into the path of bodhi. Atishas, now I don't remember very clearly the word to word of it, but the sort of rough translation of Atishas' slogan, Atishas' quote or teachings with regard to this particular slogan of transforming adversities, he says, whatever unfortunate objects, whatever different kinds of objects that are displayed which bring about attachment or aggression, may I be able to look at them as mere projections of my own mind. Whatever unpleasant sounds that I may encounter, may I have the insight to see them as nothing but echoes of my own mind. And should my body encounter adversities that impact me greatly, may I have the courage to see them as purifications of my own negative karma. This quote goes well into trying to understand how to transform adversities from an absolute perspective. All adversities, whether they are good in that they trap your mind into a self-cherishing attitude, or whether they are what are plain, mundane ways of looking at adversities, unfortunate situations, if you do not relate to them with the kind of flavor and the attitude, do situations by themselves have the power of being good or bad? Who calls them good? Who calls them bad? Padarumuche, therefore, he always says, there is no negative emotion who is independently strangulating you, telling you, please hang on to me, display me. I will give you horns and fangs, bite the other person. Never so. Everything that we have called and labeled to be negative, whether anger, whether desire, arrogance, jealousy, or ignorance, have been given that power and have been projected with the power by a mind that fuels an empty thought, that nourishes an empty thought. So Padarubhaji says, where is anger other than in your supposing it to be? Where is ignorance independently existing other than in your supposition that it is? Where is there a desire so selfish other than in your thought that it is? And so, as a meditator, looking at the immense power, color, form, and flavors that we give into a simple thought that could have a natural death, just as each in-breath, just as each exhalation, just as each inhalation arises and subsides, merging with the space. Likewise, within the sphere of one's own mind, thoughts arises. Of course, we then come in the way and we begin to distort that. We give it a name, we give it a flavor, we project it, we make it stronger, we give it different kinds of shades, and very soon, into your own creation, you begin to have so much faith that the creation itself devours every bit of sanity and awareness in one's own mind. It's quite like the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of a story. You create your own monster. And so in that similar kind of an analogy, this negativities, all the negativities that we suffer and we allow it to become a cause of suffering to the others, are creations of a mind that just begins to mix things up, muddle things up, begins to have so much hope and fear, unnecessary hope and fear, that it exaggerates and aggravates that one what is an empty thought. So therefore, what is attachment? What is desireful? What is aggressive? What is undesired? All of them are projections of one's own mind, because you give it the power, you give it the expression, you give it the name, and then it is up to you how long you want to drag it. You can drag it for 20 years, you can drag it for a lifetime, or you can keep it as simple and as short-lived too. Likewise, all sounds, as Atisha says, may I be able to have the insight to see them as echoes of my own mind. If the mind, from the very core nature of itself, did not respond to the sound, labeling it to be good, would there be the possibility then to actually have attachment to good sound? Likewise, to a sound that is what we respond to saying, I don't like it. Therefore, then making it strong enough a foundation upon which irritability can be grown. If that opinion itself, if that judgment itself was not projected to that sound, would the sound by itself have the potential of creating any disturbances? So it's anything. So any irritable sound that you do not like becomes louder and louder and louder and louder. And so it is to be for a meditator to recognize how the exaggeration, the grasping leads to the exaggeration of that particular sound does happen. When we look at our great teachers, for example, one thing you find is they have absolutely, seemingly, no difficulty in maintaining the best of awareness and calmness in any given situation. Crowded, not crowded, many people, not many people, alone with thousands of the people, there's a sense of sameness, groundedness. Now, in our case, small cell phone rings, and then there's a whole lot of flurry of actions, isn't it? I always look at what is supposed to be our shrine rooms, future Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They're all meditating. Then someone makes the mistake of bringing a child, a cell phone, or a dog most oftentimes. These seem to be the three recurring things. And then, accidentally, should one of them make some noise, there's tremendous sort of animosity directed towards that person. You can basically see the neck go red in front of every meditator. And if it continuously happens, then, you know, this is disturbing my meditation. How can I become an enlightened Buddha with so much noise and so much movement? And so those are attitudes that have to be looked at, where there is the inability to really see experiences as one's own mind, and therefore where the mind itself and its power is not being understood, its nature is not being understood. All other appearances of forms, sound, and thoughts will always be so powerful. They'll have been given enormous neurotic power to bringing about this kind of a monster that completely engulfs every bit of sanity and awareness within one's own self. In the same way, as you say, when adversities happen, may I be able to take it to the path of Bodhi, seeing it as the purification of my own karma. In connection to this particular slogan, the third aspect of transforming adversities to the Bodhi also mentions four practices: acquiring merit, purification of negative karma, offering of dharma, and making offerings to the protectors. These four are the practices that are said to be connected to the slogan of trying to skillfully, in action, engage in practices that help you reverse or help you transform what are seemingly adversities into a path of awakening for one's own self. Primarily the first two, acquiring merit and purifying negative karma. Especially in today's world where Buddhist practitioners know a lot, but most of them try to build their enlightenment on information rather than actualization and experience of the practices. So where that happens, there is no concept of merit at all. There is no concept of purifying of negativities. Take the example of prostrations, for example. Western practitioners, some of them, spend 15 years, 20 years, 25 years. Now, after that, they don't even mention it. So I think maybe more to complete prostrations. 100,000 prostrations are not difficult to complete. If you really look at all the other things that you actually are able to endure in life, 100,000 prostrations primarily are done by young people. And now again, don't take that as a reason. The young people can do it, but we old people cannot do it. You know, there's always a mistimed humility that is again used by a lot of meditators, but that is not so. But it is something that can be done in no less than 4 to 6 months, if there is diligence, if there is dedication. But why does it sin? We always try to figure out, and earlier also Jigme and we were also talking about this, why do we always seem to have so much difficulty in the rigors of practices? Is primarily because you don't really see it being beneficial for you. So you think you're doing it for somebody else. It's the tax that you have to pay for having taken on Vajrayana transmissions, isn't it? So where the concept of that action, purifying your negative karma, which is crucial to being able to free it from all the impediments of discursivenesses, is not understood, then the worth, the value, and the quality of the practice is not understood. Of course, here then, if we look at it, we think, how is it in proportion valid that you're throwing yourself on the floor 100,000 times is going to actually make you free from all the negative karmas? Now, of course, if you say it in so many words, it does seem like it's not a process of laundering negative karmas. But on the other hand, if you really took on the practice of sincerely engaging in circumambulation, in prostration, in sitting and reciting your mantras, in visualization, in a dedicated discipline of meditation, discipline each day, mind does begin to click in with that foundation of its own innate awareness, which has never been given a chance, where it has not been protected with the structures of good practice, strengthened formal practice. And so how does blessing actually happen? From the Buddhist perspective, no one gives it to you. Not even the Buddhas can give it to you. But there is the possibility of the mind's own pristine wisdom awakening to its own potential, where every word of the Dharma manifests spontaneously. However, the sort of shell has to crack. And the cracking of the shell of one's own delusions and discursivenesses require repetitions. And the repetitions and the diligently going beyond laziness, going beyond impulses that draw you back into the same habits of distraction and disturbances require the discipline of practices. Therefore, purification practices, whether it is mantra practice, Dojisenba, Vajrasattva practices, prostrations, circumambulations, sitting and doing your mantras and visualizations, are daily sessions of meditation that you need to give yourself. Even in terms of logical proportions, if you see, 24 hours of discursiveness has to be defeated by 15 minutes of some meditation. That's not being realistic. What we are asking to obtain and to realize, if the value of that is truly understood, the treasuring of it would make the disciplines of formal meditation more engaged, more ever-present, more strong. Problem is not anything but trying to get a result without your having to work for it. And then here is where the ego begins to then believe in blind faith. And gradually you begin to say, by virtue of faith alone, I'm going to actually be able to accomplish this practice or the fruition of it, obtain the fruition of it. So those are subtle deceptive tendencies brought about in the meditator's life that has to be observed. For them, the two crucial practices to cultivate are acquiring merit, doing everything within your reach and possibility to actually create positive causes that arises as merit. Merit without merit to defeat all adversities will be very difficult. It is, for example, I always say, like a person who gives generous donations, making checks out of thousands of dollars to every person you meet, fully knowing that your bank balance is zero. So without merit, trying to engage in compassion is like that. So where merit, because of the truth of cause and effect, a good, virtuous, meritorious action does plant a seed of goodness, which is favorable to your own life. While that is one aspect of the merit, the other aspect of the merit is it challenges you to bridge the gap between view and action. It allows you to actually feel the pinch. And unless you feel the pinch and the budge and the nudge and whatever else you might call it, laid-back attitude will never cease. And laid-back attitude breeds laziness, complacency, sense of conveniently trying to get the maximum benefit out of the least amount of input. Where is transformation happening in that case? How can transformation happen in that case? And then simultaneously, there is such a thing as impermanence, where impermanence slowly gives us lesser and lesser time to do something about this precious human existence, where there is an incessant creation of karma that never seems to slow down because you're not ready to fully transcend negativities into its wisdom qualities, and the rampantness of all the different negative karma, especially that are continuously created, is unceasing. Then all outer conditions of adversities continually manifest. How can a person find one's way out of that kind of adversity to build up genuine heart of enlightenment? So from a very realistic approach, to be able to really obtain realization such that your awareness and wisdom can withstand all adversities, wouldn't you like it to be surrounded by that path, that intention, to be surrounded and supported by favorable circumstances? And favorable circumstances are not going to simply drop down from the heavens. You have to create it. That creation is dependent upon creating causes that are good. That's merit. So if you really want to do something good for the others, starting from your own self, if you want to do something good for yourself, the basis of that is purifying negativities, abstaining from creating causes and conditions that are unfavorable to you, and exerting effort in creating favorable causes and conditions that surround you with favorable circumstances. Then, like a lamp that is supported by two palms on a windy day, so that the palms, the hands, protect the flame from not being put out. In the same way, the merit and the purification practices support the awakened, the inspiration to realizing the awakened mind. And that support allows lesser impediments to the path of realization. And that is how the actualization, the fruition of enlightenment, which becomes the vehicle for liberation of all sentient beings, is able to be accomplished. So in the training of the mind, these are the three approaches of working with the adversities. Working with your own self from the approach of driving all blames into the self-cherishing attitude, being grateful for all circumstances, and allowing your own mind to recognizing its relationship with all projections. Working with it from an absolute perspective, and then supporting it primarily with merit and with purity, practices of purification. These are then very crucial. So then, that's then the third point. So a little bit of the rest we can then probably touch on tomorrow. So that much for today. So thank you all. Then have a very good rest of the afternoon.